Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Every Sunday morning at 9, join me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Each week we'll be exploring the wonderful world of modern jazz. From hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz, Sunday mornings at 9 on Sheffield Live.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. We'll be talking to RPG later in this hour. Unfortunately, our regular guest speaker for the second Saturday of the month, Dr. Ogo Osamor, could not join us this week. But all being well, our guest speaker next week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, hopefully can join us. It will be Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. This show is about science in all its different forms, and we do get to play some rather cool music as well. So what's been in the science news this week then? Well, we'll start off with something our Chris told me about. Amsterdam has become the world's first capital city to ban public advertisements for both meat and fossil fuel products. Since the 1st of May, adverts for burgers, petrol cars and airlines have been stripped from billboards, tram shelters and metro stations. Politicians in the city say the move is about bringing Amsterdam's streetscape into line with the local government's own environmental targets, which aim for the Dutch capital to become carbon neutral by 2050 and for local people to halve their meat consumption over the same period. Very interesting.
Yes, and I've got an interesting story here and a very interesting long word in it.
Oh, sorry, Paul. I'll try and spell that for you.
I'll spell it. So, tens of thousands of NHS patients will benefit from a new one-minute jab that treats more than a dozen types of cancer. A new injectable form of the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab, which is PEMBROLIZUMAB, or Keytruda, KEYTRUDA, is being rolled out on the health service for 14 types of the disease, including breast, lung and cervical cancer.
You can see why they've abbreviated it to Keytruda, because the other one's a bit hard to pronounce. Meanwhile, a finger prick blood test could help suspected stroke patients by fast-tracking them straight to hospitals that offer groundbreaking procedure and boost the chance of recovery. Over the next 6 months, the London Ambulance Service will pilot the 10-minute test with paramedics checking patients in ambulances.
Wow. Right. The RSPB has recorded the second highest number of nightingales on its nature reserves for over a decade, with 176 singing males heard in 2025.
And meanwhile, one of Britain's largest parish churches could welcome new arrivals this summer in the form of peregrine falcon chicks. Officials at Beverley Minster, which we've been to and it's fantastic, said they were keeping their fingers crossed after two falcons settled in one of the towers for only the second time in a decade. According to the RSPB, or Royal Society for Protection of Birds, peregrine falcons almost disappeared from the UK in the 1960s due to illegal killing, pesticide poisoning and loss of habitat. However, changes to the law and better protections meant their bird numbers are now recovering.
Did I see a picture of some chicks in Sheffield?
Possibly, yeah.
They're on camera.
And now, a great track. Mahavishnu Orchestra, Birds of Fire.
We'll be right back.
It's rather a shame to have to turn that track off. Birds of Fire by the Mahavishnu Orchestra, of course, cracking. Because we were talking about the peregrines, which have nested in Beverley Minster. But as Paul said, it has been announced that the Sheffield peregrines have 4 fluffy chicks this year. And I think they're based in St. George's Church up near the university. So still doing very well.
Yeah, there's
stuff.
A webcam there so you can have a look at
them. Yeah, how exciting.
That's the University of Sheffield, isn't it?
It is. And if you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're every Saturday morning live from 11 till 12 talking about science in all its different forms. I saw this next article in the press a few weeks ago and I thought it was cracking. It's about optimism. So the article said, being a glass half full kind of person comes with benefits not only for your emotional state, but also for your physical health. And then it lists why it pays to be an optimist. So you're firstly, importantly, they're all very interesting stuff, actually. You're less likely to have high blood pressure. In 2020, Harvard scientists analysed data from more than 100,000 soldiers. They found that those with the highest scores for optimism at the start of their study had a 22% lower risk of developing hypertension or high blood pressure during the 3.5-year trial than those with the lowest scores for optimism. According to researchers, optimistic people, this is interesting as well, are less likely to smoke or drink to excess and more likely to work out or exercise, all of which benefit blood pressure. The other good thing about being optimistic, your immune health will be stronger. Harnessing positive thoughts could bolster your immune system, according to a study from Tel Aviv University. It was published in Nature Medicine this year. The study showed that training people to think hopeful thoughts activated brain circuits linked to optimism. When the same people were then given a vaccination, their immune systems responded more powerfully than a control group that hadn't gone the optimism training. So there you go. And if you're optimistic, you might sleep better. Researchers have proved many times that outlook affects sleep quality, with one study in Behavioural Medicine, the Behavioural Medicine Journal, showing higher optimism scores to be associated with 22% greater odds of better sleep. Another reason to be optimistic, both brain and body will age well. A study from the Yale School of Public Health the other month showed that optimism helped nearly half of over 65s to perform better in tests of cognitive and physical function as they aged. The lead researcher, Becca Levy, a professor of social and behavioural sciences, tracked the adults for up to 12 years and found that those with very positive views of ageing were significantly more likely to show improvements in cognition and walking speed. What we found is that improvement in later life is not rare. It's common and it should be included in our understanding of the ageing process. And finally, midlife optimists have healthier hearts. So people prone to negative thinking tend to be at a higher risk of heart disease, which Harvard scientists have suggested might be linked to the release of stress hormones and a physical stress response that is a risk for higher heart rate and raised blood pressure. What's more, if you are optimistic, it could be good for the heart. 3 years ago, a 15-year study of 3,206 midlifers by researchers from Harvard and Yale universities found that higher optimism was associated with lower cholesterol and bad LDL cholesterol levels, and a large review of 15 studies involving almost 230,000 people suggested that optimistic people have a 35% lower risk of cardiovascular events or heart-related events than their more pessimistic peers. So that's it. You need to be a cheerful, a glass half-full kind of person might do you lots of good mentally and physically.
Coming in fast, I see your eyes dilate when you think of the past, reaching out for some.
Nice. Track there from the Pylon Poets from 2025. One of our PG's choices, I think, for Glory Days Rock Show.
Yes.
Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, Mondays 1 till 3. And that was called Accidental Optimist. Of course, you listen to Live Sounds Radio Show, though, here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, I'm going to talk about the Peak Cluster. This article I read quite a while ago now, but this is still ongoing, of course. Pete Green, the article was titled, 125-mile pipeline will take CO2 or carbon dioxide gas from hill factories to the seabed. And it's pretty close to home as well. This article was by Lottie Hayton, and it goes on to say, from atop the hill known as Mamtor, the gritstone moors of the Peak District stretch to the northwest, to the southeast, Breedon, Scentworks belches a million tons of carbon dioxide gas into the atmosphere each year. Nature and industry vied for this land long before it became Britain's first national park in 1951. Romans quarried limestone from its hills in roughly AD 100, and this conflict has come to a head in the form of a highly ambitious project, which is a 125-mile pipeline running 1.2 metres, or could be miles, under Derbyshire, Staffordshire, Cheshire and the Wirral. Known as the Peak Cluster, it will capture carbon emissions from the Breedon Cement Works and three other industrial sites and funnel them under the seabed. The project is expected to take 3 years to complete once government approval is granted, and it'll cost £60 million. It will be Britain's longest industrial carbon capture and storage pipeline, or CCS, carbon capture and storage. Proponents of the technology say it is necessary to tackle the last 10 to 25% of carbon emissions in the UK. The government wants to achieve this target by 2050. Now, we know carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas which prevents heat escaping from the earth, said Stuart Hazeldean, a professor of carbon capture and storage at Edinburgh University. It is essential we stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Under the plans, the carbon dioxide generated by cement production at Breedon will be separated from other waste products at the site, purified, compressed, and will run through the pipeline to the Wirral coast. There it will be further processed, run offshore for about 35 miles and injected deep below the Irish Sea into near-empty aquifers, underground layers of rock that have acted as natural storage reservoirs for millions of years. The project is still in its development phase. The exact corridor, as they've termed it, through which the pipe will run is yet to be finalised. Once work begins, a trench will be excavated and the carbon steel pipe, 36 inches in diameter, will be laid and covered. The process is the same as that used for the 17,000 miles of natural gas pipelines in the UK. And the article says Peak Cluster said it hoped to minimise the compulsory purchase of land, aiming for voluntary agreements, and would avoid gardens, houses and most sites of scientific interest, with the majority of the route crossing agricultural land. Once completed, the pipeline will capture more than 90% of carbon dioxide emissions from each of the sites. Now, this technology has been prioritised in recent years. In 2023, Grant Shapps, the then Energy Secretary, promised £20 billion to six of these carbon capture and storage projects over 10 years. This was expanded by Ed Miliband, who pledged almost another £22 billion over 21 years for projects targeting industrial clusters such as the one in the Peak District. So it's pretty close to home there. Some sectors such as the cement and lime industries are hard to decarbonise because of the production of carbon dioxide is basically part of that process. Roughly 40% of the UK's cement and lime production takes place at the sites to be served by the Peak Cluster pipeline. So David Parkin, who's chairman of Peak Cluster, said cement and lime are fundamental to UK society, used for bridges, roads, schools and hospitals. Peak Cluster is set up as a collaborative project to preserve and protect key foundational industries at the same time as tackling material amounts of climate change emission reduction. Industrial scale carbon storage has already been shown to work at Brevik Carbon Capture and Storage System in Norway, which has operated successfully. It opened in June last year. Now, I suspect this article might have been written at the end of last year, so it could have been last year or the year before. It serves the country's cement and construction industries, capturing and transporting about 33,000 tonnes of carbon every month. Before construction can begin on Peak Cluster, the government must grant a development consent order. The planning permission required for all nationally significant infrastructure projects. A decision is expected to be made by September next year, but I suspect this means September this year because it's all over the press, but it's still in the early stages. Not all people are in support of the plans, unsurprisingly. Derbyshire County Council passed a motion recently urging the government to reject Peak Cluster, and many locals have voiced concern about the disruption the project will bring. I do believe in being green, and I'm against the project full stop, said Dorothy Neary, who's 80 years old and lives at Laneside Farm outside the village of Hope, in the Peak District, of course. The impact on our businesses, complaints about noise from lorries, it could impact our livelihoods. Her husband, Terence, 83, questioned whether the project would be delivered on time, citing the spiralling costs that plagued the HS2 rail link. They start out with a feasibility study, and then after the feasibility study, they do a little bit of piloting, and then the whole thing takes on a life of its own. Many locals also fear a loss of biodiversity. Peak Cluster are going to dig the pipeline through rare habitats and ecological corridors. It's not clear what alternatives they've considered. And that's according to Stuart Cox, who's a chartered engineer and environmental campaigner. But Peak Cluster says It has committed to restore any biodiversity lost, plus an additional 10% under a so-called biodiversity net gain commitment. So what's it all about then? In brief, how does this carbon capture and storage system work? Well, basically, the article, as I said earlier, carbon dioxide from the cement production at Breedon and other sites will be separated from waste products, purified, compressed, and run via a pipeline to the Wirral Coast. So first of all, carbon dioxide gas is separated from the other waste products emitted by the cement works, chimneys, purified, compressed, then run through the pipeline to the coast. Then carbon dioxide gas is injection platforms receive, condition and pump the captured carbon dioxide into underground geological reservoirs. I think this story's got a long way to go, so we'll have to see what happens.
From those before we were inspired. It's been years in the making, tenacious set of minds, determined hearts won't be denied. There are so many reasons this is no selfish plight. The spoils we share along the way. There is no place for treason, allegiance to the cause. So stand and raise your horns today. Come at us blow by
The Perfect Sea by Audio Rain. Cracking stuff, eh? We're talking about that because we're talking about the Peak Cluster, 125-mile pipeline running under Derbyshire, Staffordshire, Cheshire, and the world known as Peak Cluster. It will capture carbon emissions from breeding cement works in the Peak District and three other industrial sites and funnel them under the seabed. All good stuff, eh? If just tuned in, of course, you're listening to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every Saturday morning talking about science in all its different forms. And just before we bring our PG up, quickly about how healthy are our favourite veg. Cracking article this. Out of Britain's best-selling veg, which are best for you? Well, number one bestseller, broccoli. Love it or hate it, it's a cracking vegetable. Cheap, wildly available and practically vibrating with goodness. Those green florets are packed with fibre. A typical 80-gram portion, which is a small handful, provides your recommended daily intake of vitamin C. It's also a rich source of vitamin K, which is good for heart health. Folate, which is a B vitamin that helps you form healthy red blood cells. And minerals, including calcium and iron. Broccoli also contains glucosinolates, compounds that researchers suggest protect against certain cancers. Broccoli is considered one of the most nutrient-dense vegetables commonly eaten in the UK, says the registered dietitian Binish Suresh. Try it raw because overcooking reduces its vitamin C content. And if that sounds just too wholesome, then lightly steam, microwave or stir-fry regular broccoli and its skinny cousin tender stem. Think quick and crisp. If the kitchen starts smelling like school dinners, you've gone too far. Second one, carrots. Bugs Bunny had it right. There are few better foods to chomp on than a carrot. The orange roots and their posh multicoloured heritage relatives pip cabbage to the silver medal thanks to their versatility, fibre content and multiple health benefits. Carrots have high levels of beta-carotene, which the body converts into vitamin A to support your immune system, skin health and vision. They won't really help you see in the dark, though. That old chestnut came from the Second World War campaign. It was just a bit of what I suppose hearsay, wasn't it? Carrots are also a source of vitamin C, potassium and fibre. So go ahead and double dip carrot sticks into hummus. Absorption of their nutrients improves when eaten with a little fat. Raw carrots retain more vitamin C, but when they're cooked, the beta-carotene is more easily absorbed, so eat a mixture of both raw and cooked carrots. So of all the best-selling veg, number one's broccoli, number two's carrots. I'm now just briefly going to talk about number three, and I'll have to save the others for another time. So number three best-selling veg, this is according to Tesco, on the UK's biggest supermarket, apparently, according to this article. Cabbage is the UK's ninth best-selling vegetable, but one of the most nutritious in all its forms. Interesting. The cruciferous veg is high in fibre, including soluble fibre, which makes it great for gut health, acting as a prebiotic fuel for the good bacteria in your microbiome. Eat it fermented in the form of sauerkraut or kimchi and you'll get a probiotic boost too, as they can introduce more good bacteria into your microbiome. Cabbage is high in vitamin C, like broccoli, a source of glucosinolates. Red cabbage deserves a promotion from festive side dish to dinner table regular. This colour comes from anthocyanins, antioxidant pigments that are linked to a reduced risk of heart disease, dementia and some cancers. all good stuff then. Always good to eat more fresh veg, whatever they are. A bit of an excess there with Taste It. We talk about the benefits, health benefits of vegetables. We talked about broccoli, carrots, cabbage. I'll be talking about others in future shows. You, of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. We should have our PG on the line. Morning, PG.
Good morning.
So you've just finished eating some cabbage, have you? And some carrots, broccoli, and a big dose of optimism to go with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to eat my carrots because in the war, Cat's Eye Cunningham, that famous fighter pilot, could bring down enemy planes in the dark because of the amount of carrots that he ate.
That's, oh. I knew there was a story behind it, but yeah, and it got kids to eat carrots, I guess, as like Popeye got us to eat spinach.
It did. It was a popular vegetable in the Second World War because we could grow it quite well.
Exactly, exactly. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, interesting. I'm sort of crossing a few boundaries, I think, science news-wise. But I caught a programme on the BBC which was talking about pollution in waterways. And I raised it, I think, last week, talking about the River Wye being polluted by allegations of huge chicken farms that are up and down the Wye. And the pollution from that is either from farmers spreading the chicken poo on the land for fertiliser, or it's something directly from that. But there's a court case underway on that one. And I thought, well, how are we going to progress with cleaning up the waterways? And I came across this thing which is available on the gov.uk website, and it says that there's a crackdown on water companies that delivers record funding to restore harm done to the waterways. So I thought, oh, that's kind of a, so what's that all about? And they say in their article that there's a record £8.5 million funding secured through enforcement action, which will be reinvested directly into repairing harm to rivers and habitats. And I saw Fergal Sharkey, the singer, I think it was the Undertones, wasn't
it? Was, yes.
And he's been a great champion for cleaning up the waterways. And they were asking him about this process that the government have brought out, which is that if water companies will admit to breaches of the regulations or to pollution, rather than taking that to court and having court fees and everything else, they're allowed to give a donation to charities. So Fergal Sharkey was saying, you know, this is just a sticking plaster. £8.5 million in current terms doesn't seem a lot to try and unpollute the UK waterways, but it's a contribution. So I thought people might be interested in it. From the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, the Environment Agency, and Emma Hardy, MP, and they say that the £8.5 million compares to £5.8 million the year before. That's a 47% increase, and just under £2 million in 23-24 financial year. But I think, as Fergal Sharkey was saying, this stops any of the heads of the water companies being prosecuted and having to face consequences by allowing them to give money across to charities. So the implication is that £8.5 million is nowhere near the money that they should have extracted from the water industries if they'd taken them through the proper legal process. And I think the argument from the government is this is a quick way to get money directly to the charitable people who undertake various environmental projects, and that it's a quick way for them to get their money. So people like the River and Canals Trust get funding through this route, and they were very happy to see the funding, because I'm guessing that if it went through the government routes, that money wouldn't necessarily filter back to those kind of organisations very quickly. So it says that of the companies that have gone this route, Severn Trent Water paid the most through enforcement undertakings in the period covered, and that totaled £4.6 million. And they say all of that money was directed to local charities, including Trent River Trust and Gloucestershire Wildlife Trust, who've really experienced a great sort of upsurge in payment. So in other places, £300,000 was paid by Wessex Water following its pollution of the River Gascoyne. It'll be used by the Yeovil Rivers Community Trust to improve habitats in the area, including vital work to support endangered water vole populations. It will create reed beds, wetlands and ponds at Yeovil Country Park. And they say that the payments follow a major increase in enforcement activity, including a record 10,000 inspections of water company sites and a significant rise in criminal investigations. They've got more staff, better data and increased powers, which means the regulator can act faster when breaches occur and enable more targeted regulatory action. So, interesting approach. I don't know what you guys think.
I would quote Ogo here. Dr. Ogo Otomo comes on and talks generally about air quality and related stuff. He would always say you should tackle pollution at its source. Therefore, all right, the companies have admitted they've breached, and then they donate, you know, what you'd said about Severn Trent Water, £4.6 million. Yep. Surely they should be investing that money in their systems to stop it happening.
I think, to me, it seems like, it's a lot of the charities said, no, this is a great positive step forward, but obviously they're directly being funded through this route.
Yeah, but they're being funded to repair the damage done by systems that clearly don't work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, it's an interesting one.
Real sort of cleft stick, I think that is.
But you know, I can see why Fergal Sharkey says this is not the right thing to do. But if the government takes a company to court, that's a long drawn out process. There's a lot of money involved in lawyers and, you know, the statements and evidence. So presumably, if the company says, "Yeah, government, we admit it," which Severn Trent Water and others have, clearly by admitting it, they must be confirmed to the government they are going to change their practices as well as donating.
That's the kind of underpinning that they say is there, but it's not that obvious. I think Fergal Sharkey made a very clear point and said, you know, lock some of these chief executives for the water companies up, because it's obviously something illegal. This is a soft way for them to avoid direct prosecutions, and it's a lot cheaper than it would be if they went through the process. So, you know, fix the system, don't cheat.
I don't know if you know, but it's Fergal Sharkey's view that the water companies should not be privatised, shouldn't be private companies.
Well, I think he said, you know, if they are, they should be regulated and they should suffer the consequences. And I think that, you know, it may come out like sounding that they shouldn't be privately owned. And I think as people learn more and more about this, where you say, well, OK, that's £8.5 million, by comparison, maybe the government should have published how much was paid out to the shareholders from these companies.
Yeah.
Because quite often these kind of breaches of the regulations are allowed to carry on. So it doesn't impact these companies. And one of the sort of lead things that is, oh, you can't prosecute us to that amount of money because we'd go bust.
Yeah, but, you know, one of your hot topics has always been water.
Yeah,
as absolutely. A natural resource that we all can't live without.
Yep.
And you've got it in the hands of private companies who then increasingly charge us more and more money for the services, whilst they're keeping the shareholders even more happy, because the businesses, aren't they? The commercial businesses, they're in there to make money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a real dilemma that we've got this, and it's sort of spread across so many things. But unfortunately, it's the kind of things that people like pension companies invest in because there are great returns. It gets very messy and very complicated for people, because all of a sudden you find out, oh, this might have a big impact
on my pension. Do you know, it's all intermingled, isn't it? Oh,
yeah,
complicated.
That was really quite an interesting sort of thing that cropped up. I guess the other thing is nowadays, you know, people are travelling more adventurously and further afield for holidays. And we got the news about the cruise ship where people have been to South America, and all of a sudden people have been taken ill. Several people have now died. And the root cause of that is the orthohantavirus, which I think they call hantavirus. And the article, well, the bit of program that I saw about it said they'd called into a port in Argentina, and some of the passengers had gone on a bird watching trip. I thought, oh, that's strange. But then they said, yeah, the bird-watching trip was on a massive rubbish heap.
Oh, my word.
So they went there, and they came back, and then the initial sort of symptoms were, like a lot of things, a bit flu-y, virus-y kind of thing. But then hantavirus has been around for quite some time. And generally, it splits into two variations. One is what they call the old world hantavirus, and Then you've got the new world hantaviruses, which is caused by the similar virus in either Africa, Asia, and Europe, or the Americas. And that's the new world hantaviruses. So this trip was in South America, and the strain of the virus is called the Andean, after the Andes in South America. So it's the Andean strain of hantavirus, and it goes straight through. I mean, historically, one of the worst contagions that hit us was carried by, initially they said by rats, and that was the bubonic plague, which was a horrible thing. And quite often you'll find still in the UK ghost villages that were wiped out by the bubonic plague, which, again, like a lot of things we've talked about that are viral, you talk about it as an event, but it's not. It's a recurrent event. It's a bit like COVID. COVID's not gone away. Everybody's tried to forget about it and compartmentalize it away, but it's still there and it's still changing and still adapting moving forward. Well, that's the same thing as is happening with the hantavirus. So the moves are, I think they've flown a couple of people out to South Africa, which is where they identified it as the Andean strain. I think a couple of people have gone to the Netherlands, and allegedly someone who's the ship's doctor, who they say is British, has been flown out. But the ship is going to move into sort of containment, and Spain has said they don't want that on the mainland, so they've put it into the Canary Islands.
Oh, blimey.
People in the Canary Islands have said, well, we don't want it. But unfortunately, I think Spain overrides local needs by saying, yeah, you'll allow it to dock. We're going to take all the precautions that we need to make sure that this is not passed on. But I think there's a couple of people in the UK who are self-isolating, who've come from the cruise ship. And there are a couple of other people who appear to have moved away from the cruise ship back to other destinations. So I think we're already in four or five countries that representatives with this disease have arrived at. So the old world viruses typically cause hemorrhagic fever and kidney failure, which is HFRS. Whereas the New World are viruses, which is New World antiviruses, and they're associated with pulmonary syndrome, so heart condition. So it's already got a couple of different characteristics from where it is. But containment is one of those issues. Like we started out and we thought with COVID, if you want to see that as an example, the noises, I mean, we actually touched upon that very, very early on, I think in sort of October, November time, we flagged up that there was something happening within China, and by the new year, it was kind of a worldwide problem. So it's really difficult, I think, for people to contain those kind of problems. And where do we go from that? I think, I say, as people become more adventurous, then there's more and more chance of coming across things. They've identified that there's human-to-human transmission. Normally, it's from feces and urine or airborne pollution from the rats. But they said that people in close contact can transmit this virus. So the containment and the outcome of that containment can be very interesting to see whether we've potentially got another worldwide virus.
My word. When you go back to the bubonic plague, was that the Black Death?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so that's like Eme in the Peak District.
It was, yeah. And I think Eam now, they've got a museum with the doctor's outfit. One of those things that you might laugh at now, but they had a hat, a long cloak, but then they had a big leather cone on the front, which looked like a beak. And that was supposed keep them from the foul humours that came from people.
Yeah, but you know that I remember studying that when I was at school very young, and apparently that came from London. Was a cloth.
It was cloth, and
it was cloth, and it was fleas from infected rats.
Yep.
That came to Eam on the cloth, and of course it ravaged that village.
Yeah, well, it didn't in some respects, because they actually decided that they'd isolate the village.
They did, yeah.
And the parson, the local sort of vicar, had set up a stone on the outskirts of the village with a dimpling top and filled it full of vinegar.
Yes.
So that they could still trade, so that people put their money into the vinegar to disinfect it. As it was passing in either direction. So they did try a containment.
They did, and he was, I remember, William Mompesson.
That's
and
right.
His wife died, yeah. And I think his children died as well.
Yeah, yeah. It did affect the village. It affected a lot of people.
Yeah.
And,
but they saved the rest of the area, didn't they? By not transmitting. But it's interesting because somebody said to me the other day that this hantavirus could be contagious for up to 8 weeks.
Yeah, it's said. And basically there are two strains. So this one's come out of the new world, but there's still the old world virus. And I think we're finding a lot of resurgence in various viral diseases. Because of changes to immunisation, people's opinions about it. There's so much now, I think, with the immediacy of communication on the internet and the lack of actual control of how accurate the information is on the internet. It's one of those things where people are making choices. They're being told, I mean, I'm sure we've mentioned it lots of times, the measles, mumps and rubella package of immunisation that came together for the UK has fallen by the wayside in so many cases and so many areas, and people have made the choice not to inoculate their kids with the MMR because there were allegations that it caused autism and mental sort of problems. Lots of stuff was thrown up in the internet atmosphere, and people picked up on those kind of allegations, insinuations, and took that as a way to not inoculate kids, much the same way as a lot of people took the position on COVID, that it's just like a cold. Well, for some people it was. That's sort of strange thing. So, it really absolutely changed the bubonic plague, the map of the UK. There were so many small village and agricultural communities that were wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
And it made significant societal changes because labourers were in short supply. So all of a sudden, their salaries shot up.
Well, unintended effects. And on that note, Paul, we're going to play out with, because we've only got a few minutes left, Rat Tomago by Frank Zappa.
Oh, suck it to me.
Brilliant, Paul.
We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Great, I look forward to
bye
it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Well, he's got his own little piece of head.